Hello, this week's Brewing Podcast is with me, Guy Foster, talking to Simon Ward, previous podcast guest and author of the Money Moves Markets blog and economic advisor to Janice Henderson. It's not intended as investment advice. When investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values may increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations, and future performance may differ from that of the past. And with that said, on with the show. Hello and welcome to another Brewing Podcast. This week we're joined by Simon Ward, returning podcast guest and also author of the blog Money Moves Markets, as well as being an economic advisor to Janice Henderson Global Investors. So Simon, welcome back to the podcast. For those who haven't seen or listened to the previous edition, which you recorded for us, perhaps you could remind us of your approach to macroeconomic analysis.
My forecasting approach is based on monetary and cycle analysis. So the monetary analysis gives me a lead on the economy about 9 months ahead, and then the cycle analysis puts things in longer term perspective. There are three particular cycles that I look at: the short term stock building or inventory cycle, which typically lasts about 3.5 years. Then there's the business investment cycle, which is typically 9 years. And then there's a longer term housing cycle of about 18 years. The strongest signals from my approach come when both sides of the analysis, both the monetary side and the cycle side, give reinforcing messages, which is actually the case currently, because as I'm sure you know, money growth globally has exploded over the last couple of months. And at the same time, the cycle analysis is suggesting that the stock building and business investment cycles are bottoming. So looking out to later this year and 2021, my approach is giving a very bullish signal for the global economy.
Right. So when you talk about accelerating money flow, is that as a cause of accelerating economic activity, or is it an effect of that acceleration in economic activity?
Well, there's obviously a huge debate among economists about that question, but I see money as being the causal factor. So it's actually I see central banks and banking systems creating money, and sometimes the amount of money they create is too much for current economic activity. So there's excess money, which then flows into market and also flows into spending and results in an acceleration in the economy.
Okay, so we understand the principle then, but when you come to apply an approach like your one, when you apply it to the situation we're in now, does it still hold? Because there's a commonly held view that this is different from other recessions. Other recessions have been triggered by the business cycle. This one has been sort of self-induced by policymakers. And does that distinction affect how your approach is put into practice?
It does have an effect, but in summary, no, I don't think it invalidates the signal from the monetary analysis. I mean, if we go back a few months, at the start of the year, the monetary numbers were quite weak, and they were suggesting that the economy would be sluggish during the first half of the year. I didn't expect a recession to occur. You know, I think the recession has clearly been due to the health crisis. I'd be rather sceptical about forecasters who were forecasting a recession last year and now claiming to have been vindicated. As I say, I don't think we would have had a recession in the absence of this crisis. Having said that, I think the fact that the economy was weak has magnified the hit on the downside. So in my view, investment was already weakening coming into this year, and this crisis has resulted in the fall being obviously much greater than would otherwise have been the case.
And just thinking about the practical impact of everything that's going on at the moment, it's caused obviously a lot of disruption, not only to consumption, but also to production. So does that affect where you think we are in the inventory cycle?
Yeah, so potentially this crisis could have disrupted the cycle analysis quite significantly. But as I say, my analysis suggested that the stock building and business investment cycles were due to bottom in the first half of this year anyway. So I think this crisis has just accentuated the downswing, but it hasn't affected the timing of the bottom. And as you say, there's been massive disruption globally, which has resulted in inventory levels being run down. So I think the upswing in the stock building cycle as we come out of this is going to be much more powerful than would otherwise have been the case.
So whatever your approach to economic analysis, I think everybody assumes that the way the virus develops and spreads and whatever a second wave comes to look like is going to have a big impact on the economic outlook. So is that something that you're looking at? And if so, what conclusions are you able to draw?
It's clearly a risk. I mean, my view of the latest virus data is quite optimistic. I've been struck at the similarity between experience in China and Italy. So as you remember, China locked down in late January and their new cases peaked a couple of weeks later. And then 8 weeks after that, as new cases had trended lower, they were able to unlock their economy. Now, the timeline in Italy has been almost identical. So they locked down in early March, their cases peaked a couple of weeks later, and now 8 weeks after the peak, as in China, they're unlocking. Other European countries are a little bit behind Italy, but the trends in new cases, with the exception of the UK, are looking quite favourable. So I think we are going to see significant unlocking, particularly in Europe, over the next couple of months. And that will lead to a rebound in economic activity. Now, the second wave worry, that's more kind of 3 to 6 months down the line, because we won't know really about a second wave until then. So in the short term, I think the economic news is going to be surprising more on the upside. If we have the second wave, then obviously that's going to set the recovery back. So in terms of investment strategy, you know, I'm advocating being long cyclical assets, and we can discuss what I mean by that. But one does, I think, still need to have some hedges. So, you know, gold, I think, is a good hedge against a second wave. And treasury bonds, you know, although yields are very low, I think they're capped on the upside by the Fed. And, you know, if we have a second wave and the economy goes down again, you know, treasury yields will go even lower.
So thanks, Simon. You're obviously pretty optimistic about the extent to which the economy can recover under these circumstances. But I guess the next and most logical question is about the efficacy of the policy response. Is it what you would call a well-calibrated policy response? Is it too little? Presumably you don't think it's too little. Could it be too great a policy response? And what implications could there be?
Oh, I very much think it's excessive. I mean, my crude estimate is that the amount of money in the global economy now is 15% above where it should be. And that's the largest deviation since the GFC. Obviously, central banks eased policy massively during the GFC in order to generate a recovery. And their actions now, I think, have been on a similar or, you know, possibly even larger scale. So I think this excess money is going to feed through, first of all, into asset markets and then into the economy. So as I say, I'm expecting a very strong economy next year. And then in 2022 and 2023, I think it'll be coming through in terms of inflation of goods and services.
And what's the delay then? Why does it take so long to come through in inflation?
Well, that's always the pattern. So as I said at the start, monetary changes tend to be reflected in economic activity after about 9 months. And then the inflationary impact comes through 2 to 3 years after the initial monetary pickup.
Okay, so you talked about the impact of this on asset markets, and one of the things you promised earlier was a bit of a discussion about what constitutes a cyclical asset that might be in a position to benefit from this monetary and cyclical environment.
Yeah, so the first thing to say, I think, is the fact that equity markets globally are roughly where they were a year ago, despite the collapsing GDP and profits. You know, that on the face of it is weird. And I think it speaks to the volume of liquidity that is acting as a cushion for markets at the moment. Now, my cycle analysis suggests that market trends are closely correlated with the stock building cycle. So just to recap, that's a 3.5-year cycle. And I think we've been in a downswing since 2018. Now, during downswings, defensive assets outperform. So safe government bonds, defensive areas of the equity market, defensive markets like the US, quality stocks, all these things outperform during the downswing of the stock building cycle. And then the pattern completely reverses in the upswing, which I think we're about to enter. And during that phase, the assets that outperform are things like emerging markets, cyclical areas of the equity market, commodities. So these are the things, you know, I think investors should be thinking about increasing exposure to.
And can you talk about why those kind of assets would be in a position to benefit from this environment? Or is it just an empirical observation that historically that's what we've tended to see?
So these assets are more sensitive to economic activity. So they're defensive during the downswing, and they have a high beta during the upswing. It's really as simple as that. Now, another pattern that I've observed over the course of, you know, a large number of these cycles is that the dollar tends to be strong in the downswing phase, tends to weaken during the upswing. And if you combine that with the extraordinary actions the Fed has been taking recently, and the fact that US money growth has exploded to a post-World War II high, you know, that makes me feel quite strongly that the dollar is likely to weaken over the next 12 to 24 months. And that's another reason why I like emerging markets at the moment, because they're obviously quite sensitive to the dollar.
So some of the better performing historically assets that would not be so well placed, the more defensive assets as we move forwards, are things like technology and healthcare. So I'm sure you can understand that a lot of people would say, well, this is the ideal environment for assets of those kinds. And I wonder to what extent you think the sort of cyclical environment can dominate the microeconomic environment, as it just sort of affects those particular kinds of assets.
Healthcare might be a special case, but if one defines defensive sectors more broadly, I haven't seen anything in the recent past that invalidates the typical cycle pattern. So as I say, the stock building cycle has been in a downswing for 18 months to 2 years. These defensive sectors have outperformed during that period, as one would expect. But if one goes back further, the stock building cycle last bottomed in early 2016, and defensive sectors underperformed massively over the following couple of years. I think it's important not to fall in love with these things. I mean, ultimately, they will follow the cycle pattern. Now, if you disagree with me about global economy, then that would be a reason for, you know, staying overweight these sectors for longer. But I don't see them as being, you know, in a secular upswing, or that there's been some kind of paradigm shift in their favour.
And so we've seen quite a significant reaction from policymakers already. But I guess what's really interesting is to say, well, look, you know, how do you expect policymakers to react to the set of economic circumstances that you foresee moving into the future?
Well, I think inflation targets are basically out of the window now. The priority for monetary policymakers is to facilitate fiscal financing, because these large deficits are going to be with us for the foreseeable future. Now, in the near term, the inflation numbers are obviously plunging because of you know, the collapse in oil, as well as the immediate effect of the crisis. So central bankers will be able to say, well, we need more and more QE because inflation is so low. Looking out to next year, you know, if I'm right and the economy rebounds strongly, we'll start to see some early signs of inflation picking up. But at that point, I think the central bankers will say, well, you know, we've just undershot our target, so it's fine if inflation, you know, runs for a bit. But the bottom line is that I think they're going to be way behind the curve in terms of anticipating and trying to prevent this medium-term rise in inflation that I think is likely.
Okay, and rising inflation gets a bit of a mixed press from equity markets. So do you think this is an inflationary environment that could be quite positive for the stock market, or is it an inflationary environment that might be quite troubling for the equity market?
In the initial stages, it will be viewed favourably, I think. As I say, the inflation will reflect the fact that there's excess money in the global economy. Some of that excess money will go into equity markets. So there's no conflict in the early stages of the pickup. It's only when investors start to get seriously concerned about inflation, bond yields start to rise, that equities become vulnerable. But as I say, the central bank will be behind the curve. And if yields, you know, start to rise in anticipation of higher inflation, I think they'll step in with yield curve control policies. So ultimately, inflation will be negative for equities, but you know, I don't see that being relevant for the next 12 to 18 months.
Okay, well, Simon, thanks so much for taking us through that. And thanks also to all our listeners who've joined us for what has been a pretty in-depth analysis of the outlook over the short, medium and long term for the economy and for asset markets. So hopefully you've found that useful. And more importantly, we really hope that you will join us again next time on the next Bruin podcast. Mm-hmm.